This is Audible.
Power Moves, Lessons from Davos, by me, Adam Grant. This book isn't like the other ones I've written. Yeah, I synthesized social science research and gathered stories from some influential leaders. But instead of writing about what I learned from them, I want you to hear them in their own voices. Their challenges, their triumphs, their fears. It's meant to be listened to, not read.
My goal here is to give the human, make them smarter, essentially.
Humility starts with saying, we don't know the answers.
There's a lot of it going on in Davos, as you are observing.
He turned to his right and he said, no, this is my best side.
You know, the word ambitious, that's a compliment for a man, but it's quite negative when applied for a woman.
The reality is, we have a lot more power than we, I think, give ourselves credit for.
Money doesn't make you an asshole. Sorry if you have to bleep that. It just makes you more of who you already were.
But I would argue that's a false choice. I think we can do both. We can fix our problems here on Earth, and we can go to Mars.
Chapter 1, In the Arena.
Is this your first Davos?
This is my second, but the last one was 11 years ago, so it's pretty different. And last time I was here, I had a spouse badge. So I had a different experience because people look at the color of your badge or the what markings it has on it and make judgments accordingly.
That's Stuart Butterfield. He's back at the World Economic Forum in Davos, but now with a different badge, as the founder and CEO of Slack, a billion-dollar technology company.
So now, this time, I get sometimes like vague nods, sometimes like, oh my God, I love it.
It's not surprising that starting a billion-dollar company gives you immediate power at Davos, where every year the most powerful people on the planet gather for a week. What is surprising is that just 20 years ago, it would have been nearly impossible for a nerdy video game developer like Stuart to get into Davos in the first place. Influential companies were built over decades with many thousands of people, not in the span of a few months with a few dozen. You used to spend a whole career climbing the corporate ladder, but today you can launch your career from the corner office. Throughout human history, people have grappled with what power is and how you get it. But the very nature of power is actually changing under our feet today. As an organizational psychologist at the Wharton School of Business, I've been watching it happen. Falling CEOs, uprisings among employees, and many of the pillars of our world, whether they're century-old corporations or trusted institutions, are crumbling into irrelevance. So I want to figure out what it takes to gain power today, to hold on to it, and to wield it effectively and responsibly. And I can't think of a better place to do that than Davos.
Good evening, and a very cordial welcome to the 48th annual meeting of the World Economic Forum.
That's Klaus Schwab. He founded the World Economic Forum to improve the state of the world by bringing together global influencers from politics, business, and beyond for events and projects. Every January, the Forum holds their most famous annual conference in Davos, Switzerland. In the past, most power on display here was hierarchical. It revolved around money and status. But today, hierarchical power is melting away in an era of network power, which is about your connections and their attention, the ultimate finite resource. A teenager with an iPhone can reach more people than a corporate SVP of communications. A hacker like Stuart can build a platform that can redefine the way people communicate. And a top employee can quit at any moment and thrive working for herself. So the Forum is trying to shed its elitist reputation. They've made concerted efforts to change as well. They now invite young entrepreneurs, artists, and social activists to be part of the conversation. They put the speeches up online. They even link up conference attendees with refugees halfway across the world via video chat. And they're the first to admit that it's a work in progress. But like fallen CEOs and companies that have been disrupted by new, unexpected upstarts, the Forum is learning that power today is fragile. Even in the past year I spent writing and recording this book, some of the world's biggest, most untouchable tech companies have been taken to task by the networks of users they build. Meanwhile, the nation's largest car manufacturer announced plans to cut staff by 10%. But it goes the other way, too. Microsoft, once seen as past its prime, has made a resurgence and is now competing with Apple and Amazon to be the world's most valuable company. And one prominent investment banker I interviewed about power and culture change will return to Davos as his firm's newly appointed CEO. Of course, this could all change tomorrow, or sooner. That's the nature of power today. Change or be changed. Learn to thrive in a networked world or fall. In this new era, how do you make sure the people assuming power are doing it for good? How do you manage a workforce that's more empowered, but maybe also more entitled than ever before? And how do you help those still left behind? By institutional barriers in the workforce or a loss of faith in the government agencies once charged with helping the least fortunate among us? The place to start is to find out what power looks like at Davos. Because old power is still on display here in ways you rarely see elsewhere anymore. Your title, who you know, and what you've accomplished mean everything at Davos. Yet those who don't have the right badge or connections often take matters into their own hands. They still arrive with an entourage and fleet of black cars. But instead of attending official speeches and sessions, they set up their own series of private meetings and parties in town. Rather than asking the forum for help with a hotel, they might book a $50,000 a night chalet. They don't wait for an invite to the official conference. They just write their own ticket. That's the landscape we're all living in now. People with power, old and new, vying for a place at the table. Or at least on the sidewalk.
One of my favorite power dynamics is sidewalks.
This is Stuart Butterfield of Slack again. Before becoming an entrepreneur, he was a philosopher.
Here, they're very icy, and there's slush, and there's cars on the side. So the walking space is relatively narrow, and some people will graciously move over 14 inches to one side to help allow you to pass.
And others are human bulldozers.
Yeah, they're not going to move at all, and they will not cede any amount of the sidewalk to allow other people to pass.
These small moments contain clues about who has power, or at least who wants it. They're deeply rooted in the way we're wired and the way we interact.
You know, a lot of mammalian species have these ritualized signals to negotiate rank.
Meet Dacher Keltner. He's the psychologist who designed the emotions for the Pixar movie Inside Out. He's an expert on power, and he's seeing it in Davos for the first time.
So they pound their chests, or they have frogs croak, or stags bang their heads against each other. And we've evolved a set of emotional signals that kind of do that work. And so, you know, yesterday I was at a reception where I knew some people, and you could just see how the signaling behavior of the chest expansion and the feeling of strength and pride, some people were occupying a lot of space in the middle of the room, other people were kind of cowering toward the periphery like me. And that's one role of emotion is to signal, like, this is my role here.
Even in the middle of those crazy displays of power, many of the backroom talks are about how to hold on to power. Because power's changing, and these leaders need to figure out how to change with it.
So these are the most powerful people in the world who still have many fears. Why is that?
That's Satya Nadella. He runs a tiny company called Microsoft.
The thing that is perhaps most relevant is for people who are the most powerful people in the world to come together and perhaps recognize the limits of their power. Because that's what, you really have to ground yourself in Davos. At least that's the sort of way I look at it, which is, are the people who come there in touch with the actual limits of what is considered power? And so that you truly are able to figure out the right balance that needs to exist in the world. It's not like we have a world for the powerful and a different world for the non-powerful.
So today I was leaving from a breakfast and Bill Gates was in the line, a really, really long line, waiting very patiently to get into a hotel.
This is Claudia Sender, the president of LATAM Airlines in Brazil.
And yesterday we were passing by the Argentina house. President Macri was there. And then Angela Merkel went there to talk to him, which I thought was incredibly humbling. You think about it, the chief of such a powerful state coming to Argentina.
He's supposed to go to her, right?
Exactly. So I think it was really interesting to see the humbling experience. And then Bill Gates showed up for a meeting with him, and he had to wait. So he sat down and was chatting with the Argentinian entrepreneurs. So this is part of the experience, which I think was great. On the other hand, I've seen a lot of people who think are more important than others fighting with the co-checkers. And I think
How do you fight with a code checker?
I don't know. You're taking too long. I have another meeting to attend. Do you know who I am? Which is the typical question.
The barriers that shielded the powerful from challengers have come down. There are a variety of forces that make these barriers easier to circumvent, to undermine, or to overwhelm.
This is Moises Naim. He was the executive director of the World Bank, the industry and trade minister of Venezuela, and the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy. From his front row seat, he noticed a phase shift in how power works all around the world. So he wrote a book about it, The End of Power, which has caught the attention of some pretty powerful people. It was the first book Mark Zuckerberg picked when he started a book club on Facebook.
And so newcomers, very often small, young, agile, are very effective at either denying the powerful, the traditional powerhouses, what I call the mega players, are commonly challenged by the micro powers that have ways of competing and that are new, surprising, and unexpected. This is a trend that is not just happening in business and politics. It's happening in religion, in sports, in culture. In wherever there is human activity where power matters, power has become easier to acquire, harder to use, and easier to lose. Think about this. What are the main, most disruptive weapons of the 21st century? They are suicidal terrorists. There are cyber attacks and drones.
None of that requires an army.
None of that requires a government. Disruptive military technologies have historically been under the control of governments, of states,
state actors,
of the military. Now, anyone can develop the knowledge to launch a cyber attack.
You can see examples in every part of our lives. Small groups of people are creating cryptocurrencies to take on large banks. Upstart newsletters like The Skim are displacing major media. YouTube stars are programming their own channels.
The main powers in the television industry were the programmers. They were the people that decided what you were going to watch on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. And you have a date, you know, you had a date at the an appointment at that time, and you had to show up. Yeah. Otherwise, you were not able to see your show.
People actually used to plan their lives around that.
Now, Netflix and other streaming services, you know, you just, the power has shifted from the programmers to the consumers of television content.
And a new wave of politicians has taken us by surprise.
Donald Trump is a good example. Who would have said? Donald Trump is a perfect
example. I'm sorry,
example.
Donald who?
Donald, the president of the United States.
Him. Okay.
He's a perfect example of the unexpected player that is able to deny the established powers their will. The establishment of the Republican Party didn't want him to be the candidate, much less the president. And he coming, playing with a different playbook and essentially appending and disrupting the way politics is conducted, was able to take power.
In 2016, the earth shifted beneath our feet.
But you also say that power is harder to use. And that's the less hopeful part of the story, maybe.
Essentially, it's harder to use for a variety of reasons, mostly because of the challengers and because the barriers, the shields that protect the powerful, as I said, are more brittle. But also because the ways in which you have to manage in order to deal, to navigate successfully in this world are a bit different than what traditional rules of management have been.
Leadership is fundamentally about the exercise of power. It's the act of influencing followers to achieve a collective goal, which is more complicated today given that top-down power has a short shelf life. All it takes is a tweet storm, bad quarterly results, challengers to establish power rising seemingly out of nowhere. I've worked on some projects with Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, and he says he would approach Davos a little differently if he came here for the first time today.
Power here is seen, I think, in a hierarchical context. And partly is because the governments all understand the power of hierarchy. The more interesting power to me is the power of ideas, which is typically network-based. And so if I had as a young person, if I had a new idea, I'd set myself up on the equivalent of the digital street corner here in Davos, and I'd talk about it, and I'd talk about this new idea. I wouldn't make it very far because most of the people in Davos are winners in the old regime. But at least I would have tried, and I would have showed some new ideas.
What Eric is talking about is a young person using technology to build a network that can take down an old power giant. A network that could push a powerless nobody, or at least his or her ideas, past the soldiers guarding Davos and into the very seat of power. It's a new power dynamic that's changing how leaders manage their teams and how employees manage their careers, how women break down barriers, and how scientists break down distrust. It's a landscape that can be terrifying because it's new, even though some of the challenges, like how to use power responsibly, are as old as time. In Davos, many people seem exhilarated by it, because the opportunities are boundless. But as you'll hear, if leaders ignore the new power landscape, they'll watch those opportunities disappear right under their feet. Chapter 2, Power Reveals. One of my most vivid memories from middle school was a poster on the wall in history class. It said, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." Quoting Lord Acton, a British politician. After staring at it for 3 years and studying lots of examples, I believed it. But now I believe something different. Yeah, power changes the way we act. Sometimes for the worse. But power doesn't necessarily corrupt. Power reveals on the outside what was on the inside all along.
Money doesn't make you an asshole. Sorry if you have to bleep that. It just makes you more of who you already were.
That's what psychologists have discovered over the past 2 decades. Gaining influence and authority frees us up to show our true colors, to act on our real wishes. It releases us from the shackles of social pressure. Power disinhibits us. It's like an amplifier. Whoever we were before comes out louder. One of my favorite examples of how power reveals traces back to the late 1930s. There's a guy fresh out of law school. He was trying his first case, and the judge threatened to disbar him, writing, "I have serious doubts whether you have the ethical qualifications to practice law." That lawyer's name? Richard Nixon. Gaining power only seemed to amplify those unethical tendencies. Good morning, Watergate.
I would say only that if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation.
Richard Nixon was also an avid thinker about power, and he was a very good strategist.
That's David Gergen, a longtime advisor to both Republican and Democratic presidents. He worked in the Ford, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations. But his first White House job was as a speechwriter for Nixon.
He had demons inside him he never learned to conquer that did him in. But he thought about power constantly. Power is seen as something you put in the bank, and you try to accumulate it over time, and then you could spend it on big projects. And that's what Nixon tried to do and wrote about it a great deal. He wrote a book on leaders. It's really interesting to read it because it has this Machiavellian overview about the uses of power. And he was a student of it. He was a student of power. But Nixon threw it away. He was self-destructive.
Yeah.
And, you know, David Frost interviewed him and asked him, you know, what happened in Watergate? And why was he chased out of office? And he said, "I gave my enemies a sword, and then they ran me through." He understood.
Wow.
It was a very self-destructive set of acts that brought him down.
Let's contrast that with the story of another lawyer who was running for office and then withdrew from the election because he was afraid that his running would split the vote and cause a corrupt candidate to win. After he was finally elected president, he used his power a little differently. He held open office hours to hear the concerns of ordinary citizens, often 4 hours a day. His name? Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln's biographer, Robert Greene Ingersoll, put it best. Nothing discloses real character like the use of power. If you wish to know what a man really is, give him power.
My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
We will work hand in hand, encouraging, sometimes leading, sometimes being led.
I believe America can be better. We can be even stronger than before.
No weapon in the arsenals of the world is so formidable as the will and moral courage of free men and women.
And let every other power know that this hemisphere intends to remain the master of its own house.
American presidents sit in the ultimate seat of power, but they don't all seek it for the same reasons. For some, it's an end in itself, but for others, it's a means to an end. If you want to understand what drives them, you have to pay attention to what they say. And by listening carefully to the way powerful people express their motives, you can learn something about what your own motives are. There's a psychologist, David Winter, who spent his lifetime studying what motivates presidents and how that shapes their success. Using a coding system validated over decades, he analyzes speeches for key words, themes, and images that reflect power, affiliation, and achievement, whether those presidents are aware of it or not.
These may not be conscious, they may be even denied or repressed, but they are the long-term goals toward which people are working, sometimes unconsciously.
Presidents who want power crave influence. They talk about control, authority, sometimes dominance.
It doesn't matter whether the power image is something that the president thinks of himself as doing or expressing. It could be power images attributed to other people. Both would get scored for power motivation.
We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you.
The higher the president's power motive, the more likely the United States has been to become involved in a war.
Presidents who want affiliation are after close relationships. They talk about friendships, unity, togetherness.
It's hard to be warm and fuzzy in an inaugural address, but any reference to close relationships among people and unity, where it's not just a kind of lockstep unity, but a unity of a kind of warm, genuine kind. For example,
we are confident in principles that unite and lead us onward. We are bound by ideals that move us beyond our backgrounds, lift us above our interests, and teach us what it means to be citizens.
They tend to be involved in political scandals. They listen to their friends rather than to experts, and so they're vulnerable.
Presidents who prize achievement are constantly pursuing excellence.
Trying to do well, to do a good job, they use a lot of images like good, better, best.
Americans deserve better. And in this city today, there are people who want to do better.
Achievement-motivated people are always looking for new ways of doing things. They are not wedded to existing procedures and, quote, the way it's always been done.
And Winter has studied how Bill Clinton's motives changed over time. As he took office in his first term, Clinton's closest parallel was Jimmy Carter. They both scored highest on achievement motivation, which Winter has found predicts success in business, but failure in politics. Why?
Well, the simple answer is that business and politics are very different kinds of institutions and activities. And what works in business does not work in politics, and perhaps vice versa. If you're looking for the best and you are changing your ideas, adapting, trying to use feedback, trying something different if one thing doesn't work, that variability of your behavior can erode political alliances. Because if tomorrow you are trying something different from what you did today and what you promised to do yesterday, you are vulnerable to being called a flip-flopper. achievement-motivated presidents, they tend to be frustrated and idealistic, but in the end, they get stuck in the meat grinder of politics because they don't have the kind of control that you have as a CEO of a corporation or a company.
In the political world, success seems to come to leaders who actually enjoy politics. They're power-motivated. They see control as an end, not a means. So if you want to figure out your own motives, don't just think about what's in your head. You can actually start paying attention to what comes out of your mouth. And most of the time, those motives are only clear in hindsight. It's easy to make sense of our actions looking backward. But there's reason to believe that if you really understand motives, they could improve your foresight. The words powerful people use might help us anticipate their actions. In Davos, I met a photographer who's had a unique chance to see these hidden motives up close.
When I met W. Bush, he had just left office. And he was going through what I've seen in every living American president, a very painful transition of authority. When you leave the seat of power, you go through this awful transition because now you have something that you never had before, time. You have time to reflect on your legacy. What did you get right and what did you get wrong? And I happened to meet him on a day where he was, I think, it's only my take, that he was really struggling with that process. And the last thing he wants is to be documented by me at that vulnerable moment. He always wanted to be seen as the happy-go-lucky guy. So he walks in the room and the first thing he does, I say, you know, Mr. President, it's great to meet you. And he two fingers directly into my chest and he says, you better be photographing a guy who's happy and not some kind of snarler. Get it?
This is Platon Antonio. He's a British photographer who does portraits of presidents and celebrities, which often become iconic magazine covers. I met Platon when I was asked to moderate a session called Base Camp, which takes place at the top of a snow-capped mountain called Reinerhorn. Platon told me he gains a window into the psyche of the powerful by taking away their power.
You know, it's so revealing, the struggle of temporarily being robbed of your platform of power when you have your picture taken. It's just like going to a dentist. Right? I've had so many editors in great magazines say, you know, this young Senator Barack Obama, he's got a beautiful smile. Let's try and get that on film. But they're missing who Obama really is.
Obama was about average in achievement, above average in affiliation, and pretty high in power, though not as high as Trump.
Platon noticed those themes early on when Obama was still a senator.
He's not just the charismatic guy. He's actually, he likes to think about every move he makes. And I saw on his desk as a junior senator, he was reading a self-help book. It was called Be Quiet, Be Heard.
When Platon photographed Obama again as president, he saw him using his power to put other people at ease.
He is very aware that you're going to be a bit flustered meeting the president. And Obama, to me, seems to really care that everyone in the room is comfortable. He wants everyone to be at their best so he can maybe get the best deal. Or that's his style, consensus. So when he walks in the room, he's over there, you're over here, and you're, you know, oh my God, I'm going to meet the president. Try and be cool, act cool. First thing he does is he starts the handshake from over there. Open. Here it is. It's coming. Because when you're clumsy, you might grab his thumb by accident, and it's like, oh my God. So by the time it lands, it's perfect.
And then there was Donald Trump, the ultimate example of power disinhibiting. When Platon took his picture, there was one question he couldn't resist asking.
I said to him, dude, around you is this chaos all the time. It's like this frenetic energy that's controversial, that's aggressive, tense. And I said, as a human being, how do you cope with that? Like, what does that do to your psyche? Because I couldn't handle it personally. And I said, how do you weather the storm? And he calms down and he looks at me and he says, I am the storm.
I was curious about how David Winter would score that.
The first thought I have, I am the storm, is this sounds like the voice of God. Incidentally, President Trump scores very high, probably the highest of any American president ever, in achievement motivation. And you hear this all the time whenever he says something is beautiful or the most beautiful or the best or his administration has achieved more in less time, et cetera, et cetera. These are images of what we call success in competition with a standard of excellence.
America will start winning again, winning like never before.
Trump is, as I said, very, very high in achievement, but he's pretty high in power. So you would expect both kinds of things from him. And I Am the Storm may well be more power than achievement. It is a kind of godlike image. As a sociologist might define it, power is having the capacity to affect other people. But I think power is also, and this is what Nietzsche said, power is an intoxication. Power is an inner feeling. And maybe Donald Trump had it right when he said, "I am the storm." Perhaps that is the subjective experience of power that can be so intoxicating, and yet the act of power or expression of power is fleeting. It fades quickly, and it leaves you with a kind of empty, almost lonely feeling, because if you control the whole world, if everything moves only by your will, then you're really talking about an inanimate or dead world. I think the South African writer Coetzee has great insight into this in many of his novels. Power is, in the end, a vast emptiness. The more successful it is, the more empty the world is as a result. That may be why power needs to keep renewing, keep establishing, keep demonstrating itself, because, like a drug, you need a bigger and bigger fix because you develop a tolerance to it.
Whether we're talking about world leaders or middle managers, we know that power can bring out the best or the worst in people. The big question is, what determines which way it goes?
The underlying truth there is we are kind of impulsive beings. And when we're feeling powerful, those default tendencies are expressed.
That's Dacher Keltner, the Berkeley psychologist who's built an influential theory of power.
And so power reveals it's not necessarily malevolent. And power is going to bring out the strengths of whatever you, or your predispositions, right? When I teach the abuses of power, that's the theme that a lot of leaders keep coming back to, is we got to sort of conceptualize what we think of power means today, because we keep hiring Machiavellians or bulldogs or, you know, alpha males, and they lead us astray. You know, in the power literature, we separate like dominance-related behavior, just coercion and Machiavellianism and control, versus prestige-oriented behavior, things that I do that gain the respect and esteem of other people. And in hunter-gatherer societies, the collective respect that would be directed at individuals is very powerful. And they would, you know, disparage you if you acted immorally and abused your power, and they would respect you and be deferential and appreciate you if you're sharing and pro-social and the like. And so what that tells us is there are these two pathways to rising in the ranks, dominance and doing things that other people respect.
I spent a lot of my career studying this contrast between givers and takers. It was the subject of my first book, Give and Take. And it's a distinction that you find in every industry and every culture around the world. Givers are the people who are constantly asking, "What can I do for you?" Takers are the opposite. It's all about, "What can you do for me?" So both givers and takers can be motivated to gain power, but they have different goals for how they want to use it. Takers want to use power for personal gain, and that's what did Nixon in. Givers want to use power to help other people, and once they have it, they try to serve the greater good, which is what Lincoln was all about. You can see this in the data. Psychologists surveyed people about their values to find out if they were givers or takers. Then they gave them a list of tasks. The They had a chance to take the shortest, most interesting ones for themselves and dump the long, boring ones on a collaborator who was running late. When the takers lacked power, they were great fakers. They volunteered for the unpleasant tasks. But when they felt powerful, the takers revealed themselves. They took on the desirable tasks and stuck their partners with the worst ones. The givers used their power much more generously, shouldering the burden of the grueling work. It doesn't take much for takers to feel they have a license to be selfish. You even see it happen when they get to sit in a powerful chair. Because takers often believe that all the time they've spent kissing up justifies kicking down. Power doesn't change their goals. It activates their goals. Givers believe that with great power comes great responsibility. And you have to know that a mantra is important when it starts out in a biblical verse and then shows up in Voltaire and Spider-Man. These are fundamental values, and they have a big impact on what kind of leader you become. I've found that over the arc of a career, it's the givers who contribute the most. And Dacher has some fascinating new data on how givers even thrive in a world of takers.
Yeah. Can you talk me through that? Because when this came out, it was like, I don't know, it was like four holidays on the same day for me. Because every time I go and, you know, try to explain this pro-social approach to, you know, to power and success, people always push back and say, what about hedge fund managers and investment bankers? And here you are saying, even in that world, it's not good to be Machiavellian.
I know. You know, I mean, you and I are fighting a similar fight, and I get the same pushback. And, you know, when I speak in certain settings, people are like, what is this guy saying? You know, you do well if you're kind. And I'm like, so based on this pushback, here's what we did. First context, what about Washington, D.C., right? So we coded the speeches of U.S. senators, over 100 senators, over, I think, a 6 to 10 year period. And we coded them really, you know, it took us a long time for sort of nonverbal markers of, are they empathetic or are they Machiavellian and sociopathic? And there are pretty good cues of, you can detect if somebody's kind and empathetic.
What are those cues?
Oh, they have a nice tone of voice. They show sympathetic facial expressions. They have nice eye contact with the audience. They use we as a, right? They just have this embrace.
And you can measure all those cues reliably?
Yeah, we could measure it reliably. The Machiavellian sociopaths kind of look smug and licking their lips when they're talking about taking advantage of other people. And, you know, I mean, they're kind of, you just feel their gooey brutality, right? And so we caught this.
I've never heard brutality described as gooey before.
Unctuous, or, yeah. So what we find in the senator study is if you're empathetic and just and kind, and people will sign on to your bills, right?
And so you get more legislation passed?
Yeah. And if you are a senator who looks kind of narcissistic and sociopathic and Machiavellian, they are less likely to sign on. So that was the senator study. And then we went to the ultimate test. We had this wonderful access to, thanks to a collaborator of mine, where he had filmed, I can't remember, 150 hedge fund managers, I think.
As one does.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Really easy to do. Years of work. And so we coded these guys with the same system, right? Are they showing signs of kind of sociopathic Machiavellianism, you know, in their nonverbal behavior or more empathy? And with all the best metrics of financial returns, the Machiavellians do worse.
Why? Because this job is not supposed to require kindness, empathy, generosity.
Yeah, especially hedge fund guys. So,
yeah, what do you think drives them to perform so poorly when they lack those traits?
I mean, we find that their returns are more volatile. They're probably taking risks. If you get kind of a bunch of alpha male Machiavellian types and you have them all work on a task together, they don't get anything done too effectively. They're all doing this status stuff and not really getting the hard work done of the complicated work that we do today. So everywhere you go, people are like, you got to kill others to make it in Wall Street. And I think this gives us a moment to pause. Maybe givers do well.
So one of the best examples I've seen of a giver succeeding with a taker was at a financial services company. A woman named Kathy got a big promotion to co-lead a new team with this guy that I'll call Colin. And four different people warned her, do not trust Colin. He's going to steal credit for your ideas. He's going to stab you in the back. Watch out. The guy's a huge taker. So Kathy sat down with Colin, and she did something that very few of us have the courage to do. in their first one-on-one. She said, "Hey, Colin, I understand we're going to lead this team together, and I just wanted to let you know this is what I've heard about you." And she shared all the reputational feedback. Colin's reaction was priceless. He said, I don't know who you've been talking to, but clearly all these people are jealous of me." Thanks, Colin. Now we know you're a taker. But I loved Kathy's response. She said, "Look, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I hope it's not true, because I don't work well with people who operate that way, and if this is who you are not going to like working with me." And for the next year and a half, Colin changed his stripes. He shared credit, he mentored people below him, he volunteered for unpopular assignments. And I think what Kathy did was she made his reputation visible to him, and she challenged him to earn a new one. The good news about working with takers is that if you understand their goals, their actions are pretty predictable. Kathy convinced Colin that dominance was going to jeopardize his success. Too often, leaders fail to recognize takers until it's too late. Which brings us to a final point about personal power. While gaining power can reveal who we are, it leads the people around us to hide who they are. When I work with leaders, I've noticed they put a lot of faith in their judgment of character. Skill in identifying people who can be trusted is part of how they got where they are. The more experience they have, the better they get at it. But what they're missing is that the more power they gain, the more compromised their judgment becomes. People are more motivated to impress them. Takers are more determined to be great fakers. This is a fundamental paradox of power. It may reveal you to other people, but it clouds your ability to see those people clearly. So whether they're evaluating job applicants in an interview or entrepreneurs in a startup pitch, powerful people are often the worst judges of character.
Well, I've become very sensitive to people trying to market to me.
Once again, Eric Schmidt, Google's former CEO and chairman.
So as you get better known, more and more people come and pitch you ideas. And inevitably, they don't tell you the other side of the argument. And I'm tired of being marketed to. So if you want to have a conversation with me, tell me the good and the bad and be honest. Partly because if I'm interested in whatever you're proposing, I'm going to discover it anyway. It's much more efficient if you just tell me what's wrong with your argument, because then I'll believe you.
Do you find yourself doubting your own judgment of other people more now? Have you found ways to get more accurate information about who to trust?
There's no evidence that my judgment has gotten better with experience. I do think there are people who have extraordinarily good judgment. Our mentor, Bill Campbell, who has unfortunately died, who is the sort of greatest coach that ever lived in technology, had unusually good judgment about human motivation. So if you don't think you have the best judgment, and I certainly don't think I have, try to find somebody who has an extraordinarily good recruiting skill. Those skills are uniquely human. They have very good sense that these people will have an impact, and they're worth their weight in gold.
But you can't always rely on recruiters to judge people for you. If you have power, you have to learn to pick up your own clues. I've come to believe that the ultimate test of character is how you treat people who lack power. Do you undermine them or elevate them? Do you stifle or empower them? Do you silence them or listen to them? Think about a time when you had power and reflect on how your actions changed. That's a clue about what your motivations are. Did you find yourself pursuing more power and influence? Or did you aim for bigger achievements or stronger connections with others? And did you use power to take more for yourself or give more to others? The better we understand our own motivations, the better prepared we'll be to bring out our best impulses and keep our worst ones in check. So at the end of every chapter, I want to give some practical advice. You know, think of it as tools for becoming more powerful or for leveraging power more effectively and responsibly. We're not going to call them power tools. They're power tips. Yeah, that's it. Power tips. I think we can live with that. Okay, so power tips for this chapter are about hiring. Because I can't think of a more important decision that powerful people make than who they surround themselves with. We know hiring decisions are critical. They shape the quality of choices that you make, the productivity and creativity of your team, and the culture of your workplace. The good news is we have almost a century of evidence on how to get better at screening people in job interviews. And I've taken away four key principles. Number one, as an interviewer, you should ask every applicant the exact same questions. I know it sounds really boring, but it's the only way to compare apples to apples. Think about being in a classroom. If you have 100 students, and they all take a different test, you're never going to know who has the most knowledge. You actually have to give them the same test to be able to compare them. And an interview works exactly the same way. Number two, don't just ask behavioral questions. Ask situational questions too. Behavioral questions are the standard, tell me about a time when... And they're decent for getting a look at what people have done in the past, their successes, their struggles. But they're also imperfect, because it makes it too easy to favor the best talkers or the people who have the most experience. And you don't get a lot of insight into how they would handle this job or what they would contribute to your culture. And so you want to add situational questions too. You can say, what would you do if? That way you actually get to see how the candidate would handle a real problem that comes up in your context. And one of my favorite ways to do that is just to say, hey, look, you've been through our whole interview process. How would you think about redesigning that if you were in charge? Number three, you need a scoring key to distinguish strong answers from weak answers. The easiest way to create one is to test your questions out with your existing people. You'll see that high performers consistently answer them in certain ways, and that might look different from what average and low performers say. And that can help you build a menu of ideal and less ideal responses. And number four, get multiple perspectives on a candidate. When Google's people analytics team analyzed their interview data, they found that accuracy in judging applicants improved when you went up to two interviewers, and again up to three and then four interviewers. But once they had four, they can make hiring decisions with 86% confidence, and a fifth interviewer added less than 1% more. Chapter 3, Powerful Women.
I felt like I had to be twice as good to be taken half as seriously.
This is Ellen Stofan. She rose to become NASA's chief scientist. But earlier in her career, she saw firsthand how hard it can be for women to gain power.
I was in my early 30s, and I had an engineer who was working on a project I was directing yell at me and call me little girl.
No.
So when you have...
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. So when you have... people treat you like that. It's just demeaning. And you have to find some kind of strength that you actually didn't know you had to kind of be like, all right, let's shut that right down.
How did you respond to that?
I was on the phone. I hung up and I was shaking, you know, and my first response, you know, I'm shaking and I'm crying and I'm upset. And then I'm like, wait a minute, what was that? And so I called him back and said, don't you ever speak to me like that again. I am actually directing this project.
How did this guy react when you told him, don't ever talk to me like that again?
Oh, he was totally grumpy. Yeah.
But he changed his behavior?
Somewhat.
Not entirely.
Not entirely.
That's so depressing.
Yeah.
I hope when you became chief scientist, you put him on the worst possible projects.
Well, I will say, overall... I have been hugely mentored and supported in my career by many men who've been great. So, you know, there's all types out there.
We've covered why people want power and touched on what life is like once you have it. But what about who acquires it in the first place? Well, the bad news is that the demographic data on leaders suggests we still have a type: white, male, and tall. Even today, decades later, Ellen's story is not unique. Although the way we gain power may be changing, many of the institutional barriers that have held women back remain firmly in place. Look no further than John. According to the New York Times, in the U.S., women are 50.8% of the population, and men named John are 3.3%. Yet there are more Fortune 500 CEOs named John than there are women. This is an ingrained problem. And the solution is not to start naming our daughters John. Take the World Economic Forum, for instance. I'm on their stewardship board for shaping the future of education, gender, and work. In 2017, for the first time in the conference's history, a fifth of the attendees were female. It took 45 years of gathering powerful people from around the globe for Davos to crack the 20% barrier. A year later, they decided to make a statement by having the program chaired entirely by women, including the CEO of IBM, the Prime Minister of Norway, and the Director of the International Monetary Fund. It was a meaningful step forward, but they still have a long way to go to reach true parity. So do the rest of us. and the data suggests that we have reason to fix this problem beyond fairness and cosmic justice. In a study from 1992 to 2006, the S&P 1500 firms with more women in top management had better financial performance. The benefits of gender diversity were in innovative industries. That's where the fresh perspectives and shifts in collaboration are likely to be most useful. A few years ago, social scientists published a meta-analysis, a rigorous, quantified study of studies looking at gender differences in leadership. There were 99 different studies of over 100,000 leaders. It turned out that in self-ratings, men are more confident leaders. But when rated by others, women were actually more competent leaders. Too often, we still confuse confidence for competence. So we need to ask, what will it take to get more women in power?
It started with, as I often describe it, as one of those in the shower questions, which generally speaking, all those questions should stay in the shower.
This is Laura Liswood. She was working as a consultant, but she kept wondering how women became world leaders. And the question spawned something pretty remarkable.
At the time, there were 15 women living who were president or prime minister of their country, who had been. So I thought, well, perhaps I could meet one of these world leaders and ask them something about what's it like to be the president or their prime minister, having no idea why I thought I could meet a president. So, sort of cut to the chase, not one of the world, these 15 world leaders, turned me down for an interview.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, Margaret Thatcher did say, come back after you've met everyone else. And she was as good as her word. She allowed me to interview her. And since I'm an experiential learner, I was very appreciative I'd met 14 other prime ministers before I got to Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
But, she exhibited a trait of leadership that both men and women who are strong leaders, I think, exhibit, which is a trait of curiosity. She was curious. So my 30-minute interview turned into 2.5 hours. Because she was so curious
Wow.
what the other women leaders had said.
Oh, yeah. So that's really different from what my assumption was. I thought, she wanted to know she wasn't wasting her time and she wanted you to prove that you could do it. She wanted to learn.
Well, after she realized that I had met, Corazon Aquino, Benazir Bhutto, Mary Robinson, after she realized I'd met all these women leaders and had these long discussions with them, then she realized that, this could be very interesting.
And then I imagine it led to a whole other conversation.
It's exactly what happened. I said, do you want to meet each other? Because I'm the only one who had. And they said, yes. And so that's when we had a summit where I proposed the idea of this Council of Women Leaders, and they agreed. And so President Vigdis became the first chair of it, co-founded it with me. And so the council's been in existence and ever since. And now we have membership of 58 women presidents.
Today, Laura is the Secretary General of the Council of Women World Leaders, which might be the greatest seat in human history to understand the obstacles women have faced in gaining and keeping power.
Yes, what you see is, one, how women exercise power. What you also see is how similar women's sort of observations and complaints, if you will, are about being a woman as a prime minister or president. Every one of them, with the exception of Margaret Thatcher, I could not get her to disaggregate on gender at all. All the questions I asked, she would not talk about gender at all. But everyone else would. Over-scrutinized. The tolerance for mistakes for women was less than the tolerance for mistakes for men. Hair, dress, communication style. And you think, oh my gosh, this was 20 years ago. The current presidents and prime ministers who are members say the same thing. They're having the same thing, over scrutiny of the press, over, it's amazing. If a woman does not have other women of equal stature, if you will, or experience or whatever, to talk to, and things start happening to them, that over scrutiny or something, women will have a tendency to pathologize it.
Yeah.
There must be something wrong with me. And so I'd be going to them and say, oh, Prime Minister so-and-so had the exact same problem. Don't worry. And it was like, oh, okay.
So you were their collective therapist.
To that extent. But to help them understand, hey, that's negative social behavior. That isn't you. That's the dynamics of social, of society.
So it seems like that personalizing would be a liability. I also, though, wonder if it was an asset in the sense that these are the same kinds of people who say, you know what, I'm going to take charge. I'm going to take control over fixing it. Did they experience it as a double-edged sword?
They didn't articulate it that way, but I think I would agree with you. I mean, there's nothing wrong, and in fact, I think it's a valuable trait of a leader to actually self-analyze.
Mm-hmm. And know, even point the finger inward.
And say, okay, this behavior, if I changed my behavior here, I'd be more effective. Mm-hmm. You know, and we'd like to see that happening with more leaders. Yeah, but that notion of, okay, you know, how can I improve? And women particularly seem to articulate not the desire for power so much as the desire to have power to create change.
This distinction comes up in the data on power motivation. It turns out that men and women are equally interested in power, but it has different effects on them. Remember all those studies about how power disinhibits? Gender matters. David Winter found that power-hungry men are more impulsive and more aggressive verbally and physically.
Profligate impulsivity, by which I mean verbal aggression, physical aggression, multiple drug use, alcohol abuse or heavy use, and sexual exploitation. It looked like in men that was correlated with power motivation, but in women it wasn't.
If men are at risk of getting drunk on power, women are more likely to stay sober.
Women do get trained to express power in very socialized ways, and men often don't. If you look cross-culturally at what little girls and little boys are trained to do, very often boys are kind of allowed to do chores like mowing the lawn and so forth, which are chores, but they don't require a whole lot of responsibility, whereas girls are often recruited at a very early age to do two things. One is prepare food, and the other is take care of younger children, where it's important that you don't screw up. And so there's a kind of responsibility training that takes place at a very early age for girls.
Women tend to approach power more like givers than takers. Political scientists find that when countries have more female legislators, they're less likely to go to war and escalate conflicts. And when women participate in peace agreements, they're less likely to fail and 35% more likely to last at least 15 years. Laura had a chance to see how women break through the barriers to power. Some rose during crisis.
Just when the country's crumbling, people go, oh, let's try a woman now.
Social scientists call it the glass cliff. Women are stereotyped as more understanding than men and more helpful and more cheerful. So they're often elevated to power to handle delicate and precarious situations, which of course means they'll be more likely to fail and get judged more harshly when they fail. But Laura also noticed another path to political power, family experience. Sure, there were women who followed their husbands or fathers, but more interesting were the women who were inspired by incompetent relatives.
And then there was also the phenomena of what I call, you know, I have these real scientific terms for this stuff, the Uncle Fred theory, which which is, you know, most of them had someone in their family who was involved in politics. But it could be at just at the local level. But people, I think for the women, they go, well, you know, my
Uncle Fred could do it. Anyone could do it.
The idiot can do it. You know, I can do it, you know, kind of thing. You know, even Margaret Thatcher's, you know, father was the mayor of Grantham, a little town. Mm-hmm. So there was a familiarity for them that gave them, a little bit more sense of confidence that they could enter into this realm.
That's such an interesting alternative to the you can't be what you can't see narrative, which is all about, you know, if I want to be a successful woman leader, I need role models of women leaders. And you're saying something a little different, which is you could have role models of really incompetent men that are also empowering.
Well, I think they're over the dinner table, there's have these discussions. And so I think it is important to have female role models. Obviously, you can't be what you can't see kind of thing. But I think it is just important to have these sort of notions of familiarity around the dynamics of the industry that they're trying to get into. Now, for men, it's also very interesting, some research. You know, women feel perfectly capable of running for a school board.
Right.
For their first elected office.
Sure.
You know, men's first elected office is like, oh, I could be governor.
And some women gain power by expressing that same kind of confidence. Take Margaret Thatcher.
She definitely took on the coloration of the species she was trying to invade. No question.
You think she took that on, or do you think she just happened to have relatively stereotypically masculine traits from the get-go?
Well, if you're the only O in a room full of X's, chances are your only strategy is you're going to turn yourself into an X.
Yeah. Yes.
So she was the only O in a room full of X's, mm-hmm. you know, as a woman in politics in Great Britain at the time. So she adapted that. And, of course, the famous stuff about her taking speech lessons
yes.
and everything like that. It was all true.
Here's Thatcher in 1960, early in her career.
I mainly do the catering here. I like cooking and I do the shopping and always a big batch of cooking at the weekend.
And this is from 1990, when she was prime minister.
Iraq has violated and taken over the territory of a country which is a full member of the United Nations. That is totally unacceptable.
But it's a double-edged sword. While some women might try to emulate male stereotypes to get ahead, the evidence is overwhelming that we don't like ambitious women.